man post to do a new accounting on all our dead and wounded. And I told Myron Dieterich to take his company out on one final lateral sweep across his front 150 yards out. That area had been the scene of the heaviest hand-to-hand fighting, and I wanted it searched one last time. I was determined to keep my promise that this battalion would never leave any man behind on the field of battle, that everyone would come home. Platoon Sergeant Fred J. Klug of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry, was moving his men into the fighting holes along the old perimeter.
Two of my men called me over and pointed. There was a dead American sergeant in the bottom of the foxhole. I looked at him and couldn't help thinking, he looks just like me. I told the two troops, get him by the harness and drag him to the choppers. Someone came up behind me and said, no, you won't do that, Sergeant. He's one of my troopers and you will show respect. Get two more men and carry him to the landing zone. It was Colonel Moore, making a final check of his positions. If we hadn't found that sergeant, he would have. I had cause to remember his words and repeat them just 2 days later.
Near noon, a Chinook loaded with reporters, photographers, and television crews landed an X-ray under escort by Captain J.D. Coleman of the division's public affairs office. Grimed, numbed, and half-deafened by 2 days and nights of combat, Joe Galloway stood and watched others of his profession fan out nervously and try to make sense of this battle. Frank McCulloch, Time magazine's Saigon bureau chief at the time, says, a helicopter load of us reporters flew into LZ X-ray on the third day. A few rounds came in and we all flopped down on the ground. We looked up and there was Galloway standing up saying, bullshit, that stuff ain't aimed at us. Charlie Black of the Columbus, Georgia Ledger-Inquirer came up and hugged Galloway. The two walked away from the crowd and Galloway tried to tell Black something of what had happened in this place, something that Black typed up on his battered old portable typewriter for one of the long reports he emailed home, to be published in the 1st Cavalry Division's hometown newspaper, read by the wives and children of the soldiers. Charlie, these are the greatest soldiers that have ever gone into a fight. There hasn't been any outfit like this before. It's something I wish every American could understand what these kids did. Look over there. Doesn't that make you feel good? The young reporter turned the older one toward a section of the perimeter where a GI had planted a small American flag atop the shattered trunk of a tree. J.D. Coleman describes the moment and the vision of that little flag in his book Play Coup, The Dawn of Helicopter Warfare in Vietnam. True, it was a cliché camera shot from every war movie ever made, but there on LZ X-ray in the midst of death, destruction, and unbelievable heroism, its impact transcended the stereotype. The other reporters now clustered around me. I told them that this had been a bitterly contested battle, that clearly we were up against a brave, determined, and very tough enemy in the North Vietnamese soldiers, but that American firepower, discipline, guts, and will to win had carried the day at LZ X-ray. Brave American soldiers and the M-16 rifle won a victory here, I said. My voice choked and my eyes filled with tears as I told the reporters that many of my men who had been killed in this place were only a matter of days away from completing their army service, but they fought and died bravely. As I stood there, I knew that the telegrams that would shatter the hearts and lives of scores of American families were already being drafted. Charlie Black came up. I had last seen him at the Kateka Plantation airstrip 6 days earlier as we launched our operation into the Plan May area. Charlie was on his way out for 2 hard weeks of covering the 1st Brigade actions. I urged him to come along with us. Charlie Black was welcome in every unit of the 1st Cavalry Division. He wrote for the paper read by our families. Charlie begged off, opting instead for a few days R&R in Saigon. Now I teased Charlie about missing out on the biggest battle of the war. He flashed his gap-toothed grin and took my ribbing good-naturedly. Then New York Times reporter Neil Sheehan, who had been wandering around the perimeter interviewing the troops all morning, came over to talk to me. I knew he was an old hand in Vietnam and a sharp, serious observer.
Standing near my Anthill command post, Sheehan told me, "This could be the most significant battle of the Vietnam War since Ap Bac." He was right. I turned back to business. The battalion rear command post radioed a report that all the men of my battalion and attached units from the 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry had been fully accounted for and evacuated. Not one single man was missing. Diederich's company reported back from their final sweep across the battlefield. No American casualties found. Those reports convinced me we had no MIAs on our conscience, so I gave Dylan the nod to begin lifting our men out of X-ray. At 11:55 a.m., the first unit to leave was Bob Edwards' Charlie Company, what was left of it. Dick Merchant says, "My final task was to run the pickup zone for the battalion. It seemed to take forever. Four ships at a time with a load of four troopers each. Why only four men on a helicopter that could carry 10 at a pinch? Because each helicopter hauled out not only men, but heaps of enemy weapons and our own excess weapons and equipment. In my after-action report, I would urge that the Army establish tighter control on both friendly and enemy weapons evacuated from the battlefield. We lost a lot of our own weapons, which were taken from our wounded men at the hospitals, and many of the enemy weapons captured and sent out for evaluation by our intelligence officers simply disappeared, siphoned off for souvenirs by rear area commandos, medics, and helicopter crewmen. We shipped out of X-ray 57 AK-47 assault rifles, 54 SKS carbines, 17 Degtyaryov automatic rifles, 4 Maxim heavy machine guns, 5 RPG-2 rocket launchers, 2 82mm mortar tubes, 2 9mm Chi-Com pistols, and 6 enemy medic kits. Engineers collected and destroyed another 100 rifles and machine guns, 300 to 400 hand grenades, 7,000 rounds of ammunition, 3 cases of RPG rockets, and 150 entrenching tools. Now came the body count. From the beginning of the fight, I had known that a higher headquarters would eventually want to know what damage we had done to the enemy. So after each major action in this battle, hating it, I asked my company commanders for their best estimates of enemy killed. With the battle raging back and forth over 3 days and two nights, it was anything but orderly. There was no referee to call time out for a body count. We did the best we could to keep a realistic count of enemy dead. In the end, it added up to 834 dead by body count, with an additional 1,215 estimated killed and wounded by artillery, air attacks, and aerial rocket attacks. On my own, I cut the 834 figure back to 634, a personal allowance for the confusion and fog of war, and let the 1,215 estimated stand. We captured and evacuated 6 enemy prisoners. On our side, we had lost 79 Americans killed in action, 121 wounded, and none missing. But the body count on both sides, tragic as it was, did not go to the heart of the matter. What had happened here in these 3 days was a sea change in the Vietnam War. For the first time since Dien Bien Phu in 1954, the North Vietnamese Army had taken the field in division strength. People's Army soldiers were pouring down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in unprecedented numbers, and now they had intervened directly and powerfully on the battlefield in South Vietnam. 79 Americans had been killed in just 3 days in X-ray. The cost of America's involvement in this obscure police action had just risen dramatically. Vietnam was now a whole new ballgame militarily, politically, and diplomatically. Decisions would have to be made in Washington and in Hanoi, and they would have to be made soon. For now, however, my first priority was getting my troopers out of LZ X-ray safely and quickly, and turning responsibility for this battered, blood-soaked piece of earth over to Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully.
Sergeant Glenn Kennedy and a small group of 48 other Charlie Company survivors landed in LZ Falcon at 12:20 p.m. They got off the Hueys and sprawled in the grass in the sun, waiting for the Chinook that would carry them on to Camp Holloway. Delta Company began lifting out of X-ray at 12:45 p.m. Specialist Vince Cantu waited to be called. He says, "Chopper after chopper would fill up and take off. It seemed to take forever. The waiting was stressful. But we waited our turn. After we were airborne, I remember praying, 'Please, dear Lord, don't let them shoot us down.' I had seen two choppers and a plane shot down. I thought, 'You wouldn't bring us down now after you let us survive 3 days and two nights of hell.' God watched over us. He brought us home. When they pulled us out, I had 6 days left in the army. I came home complete, not even a scratch. Some of my friends weren't so lucky. I think about them often." Specialist for Willard Parrish, another Delta Company trooper, recalls his last act in X-ray. "Some things you remember. We were burying our sea ration cans and things like that, getting ready for choppers to bring us out of the valley. When we dug our foxhole, there had been a small bush on the right corner, and it was loaded with leaves. As we were sitting there getting ready to go, I looked at it, and there was only one leaf left in it now. For some reason, I don't know why, I reached over and plucked the last leaf off that bush and left it bare." Lieutenant Rick Rescorla, "We were flown away, but the stench of the dead would stay with me for years after the battle. Below us, the pockmarked earth was dotted with enemy dead. Most of the platoon was smiling. Suddenly, a grenadier next to me threw up on my lap. I understood how he felt. He was like many a man who had fought bravely enough, though he had no stomach for the bloodletting. Each soldier would see the battle through his personal lens. Tactically, it had been a find-em, fix-em, and finish-em action, right out of the Benning School for Boys. A tidy show, and the NVA had been defeated piecemeal, feeding their units one by one into a meat grinder." Joe Galloway shot a few final photos of Tony Nadal's weary soldiers clumped around the termite hill, gathered his own rifle and pack, and approached me to say farewell. We stood and looked at each other, and suddenly and without shame, the tears were cutting tracks through the red dirt in our faces. I choked out these words, "Go tell America what these brave men did. Tell them how their sons died." He flew out to play coup and dictated his story over the military telephone system to the UPI Bureau in Saigon. Next day, his story of the fight at the base of Chu Pong Mountain stunned our families back at Fort Benning and shocked the world. In Columbus, Georgia, my wife, Julie, got the kids off to school and picked up the Enquirer that morning. The first paragraph of the story, it was written by Joe Galloway, said the battle was the bloodiest in Vietnam history. Then, in the next paragraph, he quoted my husband. I had to take a deep breath before I read the rest. When Galloway finished dictating his story, the UPI assistant bureau chief, Bryce Miller, asked, "By the way, did you hear about Dickie Chappelle? She was killed in an operation with the Marines." Galloway walked out on the steps of the barracks at the MACV, Military Assistant Command Vietnam II Corps compound, and sat down. Dickie Chappelle, an old pro who had covered a dozen wars and revolutions, had been a good friend and offered good advice to someone new to the game of war. Galloway sat there in the dark, shaking silently and weeping for his old friend and for all the new ones who had died beside him this week. It was going to be a long war. For the job he did in the Iadrang Valley, UPI raised Galloway's salary from $135 a week to $150. When he later told his mother about the raise, she shook her head and said it was blood money. Galloway thought that maybe she was right, but it certainly wasn't much money for so great an amount of blood.
Captain Bruce Wallace and his A1Es covered our withdrawal from X-ray. There came a time toward the end of X-ray when it became clear to me that leaving an area was often as difficult and dangerous as arriving. We put a screen of ordnance between the enemy and the LZ to interrupt his activities long enough to get a flight of choppers in, loaded, and back out again. I remember the sound of the guns through Charlie Hastings' microphone as he was boarding the chopper, and my own feeling of relief when they got airborne. I led that last flight of Sky Raiders to cover the 1st Battalion 7th Cavalry's exit from the Iadrang Valley. That mission ended my personal participation with the 7th Cavalry at X-ray. It was almost 3 p.m., and there were only a few of us left in the command post to load out. Matt Dillon, Charlie Hastings, Jerry Whiteside, the radio men, Sergeant Major Plumley, Bob Ouellette, and myself. Plumley, Ouellette, and I were the last to leave the termite hill. We trotted over to the 4th Huey in the final lift. It was waiting, blades turning, pointing west. Plumley and Ouellette jumped on. Then I hopped in on the left side, and we took off in a sharp bank to the north. As I looked down at the battle-scarred earth and shattered trees below, I felt pride in what we had done, grief at our losses, and guilt that I was still alive. Chapter 17. It Ain't Over Till It's Over. Those who do not do battle for their country do not know with what ease they accept their citizenship in America. Dean Brellis, The Face of South Vietnam. It was a short, fast ride to Landing Zone Falcon, just 5.5 miles east of X-ray. As we landed among the artillery pieces, I saw, 75 yards away, a group of my troopers off the northwestern edge of the LZ. They were in the dry, beaten-down elephant grass, waiting for the Chinooks to fly them back to Camp Holloway. Sergeant Major Plumley and I headed in that direction and quickly recognized them as the 70 or so men of Captain John Heron's Bravo Company. We walked among them, and I shook their hands and thanked them for all that they had done, looking into their glazed eyes. We were all so worn out, none more so than Bravo Company. John Heron and his men had been without sleep for 81 hours. We were all terribly saddened by the deaths of our comrades. Dean Brellis, an NBC News correspondent, was an LZ Falcon that afternoon. He captured the scene in his 1967 book, The Face of South Vietnam. Hal Moore was the last man to come out of the battle. It was the biggest battle he had ever fought. He was a lieutenant colonel, and he carried himself like a proud man. His sergeant major was at his side. It would need a Shakespeare to describe what happened then. But it was something that was love and manliness and pride. It was the moment of the brave. Hal Moore turned and went from group to group of his men. And only a few bothered to get up because there was no exclusivity now, no rank. And Hal Moore did not want them to stand and salute. He was saluting them. He talked with them. He thanked them. He was not solemn, and he did not bring to his greetings the salutations of a politician. There was no poverty of spirit in his handshake, and he shook every man's hand. It was a union of the men who had met and defeated the enemy, not forever, not in a victory that ended the war, but in a victory over their uncertainty. When their hour had come, they had done their job, and it was this thought, too, that Hal Moore had in his mind. And he said that if they had won no one else's gratitude, they had his. After 40 minutes or so with Heron's company, we walked over to the artillery positions, manned by A and C batteries of the 1st Battalion 21st Artillery, and commanded, respectively, by Captain Don Davis and Captain Bob Barker. They called themselves the Big Voice of Gary Owen at this point. But in November of 1991, a quarter century later, Joe Galloway found one of those same artillery batteries supporting the 1st Cavalry Division in the Saudi Arabian desert. A bright young captain from Virginia, who knew his history and his man, saluted the reporter and told Galloway proudly, "Sir, we call ourselves the Falcons, and I expect that you know why better than almost anyone else. We are the artillery that supported you in your time of need in Landing Zone X-ray."
He insisted that Galloway inspect the battery before joining his men for Thanksgiving dinner. I asked Barker and Davis to gather their gunners. The artillerymen who had fired more than 18,000 rounds over 53 straight hours were exhausted. Huge mountains of empty brass shell casings had grown beside their guns. The gunners who gathered in front of me were stripped to the waist, their skin dyed red from the dirt and sweat. I thanked them from the bottom of my heart. I told them exactly what their barrages of high-explosive shells had done for us in the heat of battle, and what they had done to the enemy. First Sergeant Warren Adams ran into an old friend who was top sergeant of one of the batteries. Says Adams, "He told me, we melted out a few tubes trying to get you guys warm up there." SFC Clarence W. Blunt of Pensacola, Florida, was chief of a firing section in Captain Davis's battery. Almost 20 years later, he wrote me, "I remember you and Sergeant Major Plumley came to our gun position and you gave our entire unit a fine speech for the great artillery support that we provided during the battle at X-Ray. That speech made a lasting impression on me. I felt that my usefulness to my country, the Army, and my unit was really at its peak at that time. I have been wanting to say that to someone for a long time." Barker recalls, "There were numerous times during X-Ray that my battery exceeded sustained rates of fire. Recoil mechanisms failed on two howitzers early the second day. An ordnance team quickly repaired them that morning. When Lieutenant Colonel Moore's battalion was pulled out of X-Ray, he talked with all the artillerymen in Falcon. His words made the cannoneers feel they had played a very significant part in the battle." Later, as the Chinooks began ferrying the troops to Camp Holloway, Plumley and I stayed behind a while longer, talking with the artillerymen, before boarding the Huey for the ride back. We were not present to see what reporter Dean Brellis witnessed at Holloway and recounted in his book. By late afternoon, they were all back at Pleiku. They walked off the big Chinooks, and without anyone giving a command, they straightened up. They were not dirty, tired infantrymen anymore. Hal Moore's battalion voluntarily dressed their lines as if they were coming back to life. And the GIs who had not been in the Ia Drang glanced at them with something approaching awe, because these were the guys who had been in it. No cheers, but they could not conceal their admiration. A few GIs were taking pictures as we went by. There was something dramatic in the scene, all right, because Hal Moore's men had not yet thrown off what they had been through. There was no shouting, no telling off the ones who had been lucky enough to stay back, because that was the luck of the draw. But the signal had passed through these men that they were coming back to base camp, and they just couldn't march in as if nothing had happened, because a great deal had. They marched jauntily and smartly, without making it a production. You would have too if you had been one of them. The GIs with the clean faces and uniforms watched them to see what they could tell about combat from these men. It was the kind of scene that Hollywood could never produce, because the men had the dirt and gore of combat completely drenched into them. You can only get that dirty and that proud if you have been in combat and survived it. You can't put it on. In the cockpit of the Huey flying Plumley, who led in myself toward Pleiku, was Serpent Six, Old Snake, Major Bruce Crandall. Beside Crandall was his co-pilot, Captain John Mills. Old Snake had taken us into this thing, and now he was taking us out. When we landed and shut down at Camp Holloway, the Sergeant Major and I left to make sure that our troopers were being well taken care of. But before walking off, I told Crandall that after all that had happened, I sure could use a drink. Old Snake pointed out a small, gaudily painted Quonset Hut officers' club nearby, and we agreed to meet there later. Plumley and I found that the troops were doing all right. They had been given hot showers, clean fatigue uniforms, hot chow, cold beer, and some pup tents for shelter. After the experience of the Ia Drang, this was almost wallowing in luxury. Gunner Bill Beck, "We were issued new clean clothing. How bloody my own clothing was. Shoulders, arms, front, back, legs. Christ, that's what I remember most about the Ia Drang, how goddamn bloody it was." Mortar Observer John Willenius, "We were withdrawn back to Pleiku for some R&R. Seems to me we got back in time for a hot supper. We slept near the airstrip on the ground." Specialist 4, Ray Tanner,
When I got back to our staging area at Play Coup, we all started trying to find out who was missing. I had a homeboy in Charlie Company 1-7, so I went looking for him. At the same time, he came to Delta Company to find me. Each of us was told that the other had been either killed or wounded. We bumped into each other moments later on the way back. It was a wonderful reunion. Never let it be said that fighting men are afraid to hug and cry. We did both. His name is Hardy Brown.
Sergeant Steve Hansen recalls, "Goddamn drunk at Camp Holloway. Also remember the first meal we got, canned B-ration hamburger patty served hot out of Marmite cans. Tasted like steak. One of the cooks apologized to every man because it was all they had. I remember feeling that I had been tested and found to be a man." Assured that my men were being taken care of, I rejoined Bruce Crandall and John Mills and we headed off for that drink. I was still wearing my grimy, frayed, old World War II-style herringbone twill fatigue that I had lived in for the last 5 days. In Play Coup, The Dawn of Helicopter Warfare in Vietnam, J.D. Coleman tells what happened next. When they walked up to the bartender told them he couldn't serve them because Moore was too dirty. Mills remembers how Moore patiently explained that they had just come out of the field and would really appreciate a drink. The bartender replied, "You're in the first calf. This club doesn't belong to you. You'll have to leave." Mills says that was when Hal started to lose his patience. He said, "Go get your club officer and we'll settle this. But right now I'm here and I'm going to have a drink. And I would like to have it in the next couple of minutes." The bartender beat a hasty retreat to summon the club officer, but still refused the trio service. So Moore unslung his M16 and laid it on the bar. Mills and Crandall solemnly following suit with their 38s. Moore then said, "You've got exactly 30 seconds to get some drinks on this bar, or I'm going to clean house." The bartender got smart and served the drinks. By this time, the club officer had arrived. He had heard all about the fight in the valley and knew who Moore was. And as it turned out, so did most of the customers in the club. From then on, the trio couldn't buy a drink. That was when they knew that the fight on LZ X-Ray was finally over. Bruce Crandall pulled out a box of Behring cigars, the kind that come sealed in aluminum tubes. He passed them around. I fired one up, sipped a cold gin and tonic, and let my mind go blank. Lieutenant Rick Rescorla, the tough Englishman, remembers that night. "After a shower, but no fresh clothing, I joined the officers of the 1st of the 7th at the Holloway Club. We savored the cold beer, but did not go overboard. There was no boisterous celebration of our victory. We had all lost close comrades. We gravitated in a tight circle around Colonel Moore. He could not have moved if he wanted to. The nearest men were jammed up against him like a rugby scrum. Every few minutes, the 4 or 5 men closest to him would be gently edged aside, and the outer circle would become the inner one. The inner circle locked eyes with the commander. Unspoken mutual respect was exchanged. Now and then someone would grunt, 'Gary Owen,' or 'shit,' with the same tone as one would say, 'Amen.' All 12 or so sweating officers had learned something special about themselves and each other while serving with Hal Moore in the 7th Cavalry in the Yadrang Valley. We were all exhausted. That and the drinks and the emotion and the feeling of security did us all in after an hour or two, and we drifted off to catch some sleep. I went to the battalion operations tent, which was quiet but operating normally. Staff Sergeant Robert Brown was the NCO on duty. I stretched out, boots and all, on the bare canvas of a folding GI cot and was instantly asleep. When I awoke at daybreak on November 17th, I noticed that sometime in the night, Sergeant Brown had covered me with a brown wool GI blanket. Back on Landing Zone X-Ray, it had been a relatively quiet night for Bob Tully's 2nd Battalion 5th Cavalry and Bob McDade's 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry. Quiet, but both units were on 100% alert, Sporadic rifle fire, a few mortar rounds, and the continuing American H and I fire kept everyone awake. That, and the growing stench of hundreds of dead bodies ripening in the heat, prevented sleep, even if it had been permitted. Colonel Tim Brown had alerted both battalion commanders to prepare to pull out of X-ray the next morning. B-52 strikes would be targeted on the near slopes of Chu Pong, and the American troops would have to be at least 2 miles away from the impact area. Departure time was set for 9 a.m. Both battalions would march northeast with Tully in the lead, headed straight for Landing Zone Columbus. McDade's battalion would follow Tully's initially, then turn west and northwest toward a small clearing codenamed LZ Albany. McDade's battalion had lost Myron Duderick's Bravo Company and one platoon of Alpha Company, now back at Holloway for much-needed rest, but Tim Brown had attached Captain George Forrest's Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry to McDade to make up the difference. Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully had commanded his battalion for 18 months. He knew his officers and men personally. He had trained them himself. By the luck of the draw, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McDade, a three-war man, had commanded his battalion less than 3 weeks. For the previous 18 months, he had been the Division G1, or Chief of Personnel, and almost 10 years had passed since he had been in command of troops. Although McDade had commanded a rifle platoon in the South Pacific in World War II, and a rifle company in Korea, and wore 2 Silver Stars and 3 Purple Hearts, he was feeling his way into this war, and this command, very carefully. McDade had done a good job as personnel chief for the division commander, Major General Harry W. O. Kennard, and Kennard had rewarded him with a battalion command. But not without some reservations. He assigned his own personal aide, Major Frank Henry, to go down to the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, as McDade's executive officer, to keep things going until McDade could get his feet wet. The 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry was the same mix of draftees, good NCOs, green lieutenants, and good company commanders that were found in its sister 1st Battalion, 7th Cav. But it had not had the same intense airmobile training that we had gotten in the 11th Air Assault Test. When the 1st Cavalry Division got orders to Vietnam, the Army handed 2 additional infantry battalions to General Kennard in July of 1965 to fill up the ranks. The 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav was one of those battalions. Colonel Tim Brown recalls, "When they joined us, they were scattered all over the country. Some units at Bragg, some at Fort Jackson, just scattered. I asked the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel John White, how many men he had. He said he had 100 men for the whole battalion. So the Army started filling that battalion with people from the 101st, the 82nd Airborne, some from Fort Lewis. They were just a bunch of strangers to each other. Hell, I rounded up some helicopters and had them take the 2-7 troops up for a ride, just so they would know what it was like in a helicopter. That was all the airmobile training we had time to give them at Benning." The battalion Sergeant Major James Scott says, "We got a lot of replacements in, filled up our battalion prior to joining the cavalry. Airmobile training. We had precisely 1 helicopter ride at Fort Benning, and that was our airmobile training. No more than 2% of the whole battalion had any combat experience. Frightening to think of. We were definitely new and not trained as a unit in airmobile operations." 1st Lieutenant J.L. Bud Alley, Jr., a native of South Carolina, had joined the 2nd Infantry Division in August 1964, directly out of ROTC at Furman University under an experimental program the Army called U-2. It took a new ROTC graduate and put him directly on active duty in command of troops without first sending him through the officer's basic infantry course. "I spent 3 months directly in the field in Air Assault II. I was in the 1st Battalion, 9th Infantry, and we were a mech infantry unit. They were practicing air assault against us. We came back in from the field of Thanksgiving. Then on 15th of February, 1965, I was sent to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to Communications Officer School. That took 3 months. When I came back, we were moved to Fort Bragg to take over training duties because the 82nd Airborne Division was in the Dominican Republic, and they had a bunch of new people turning up, and nobody at Bragg to deal with them. I was there at Bragg in July when President Johnson went on television and said the Air Cavalry Division would be deployed to Vietnam. Next day, we got called back to Benning. I was immediately assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 9th Infantry, on the day that it was redesignated the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. It was a remnants outfit, with new people turning up every day. Nobody knew anything, and nobody knew anybody. It was a blur of disposing of POVs, privately owned vehicles, and POE, preparation for overseas embarkation and packing up. Airmobile training. Hell, I had my first helicopter ride in my life from the beach in Quy Nhon to division headquarters at An Khe in Vietnam. Lieutenant Ali says he thought the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav was a pretty decent unit, no better and no worse than most of the rest. The NCOs and staff people were good. Captain Jim Spires, Battalion Operations Officer, was top drawer. And I can't say enough good about Major Frank Henry. He was a first-rate guy, a real cool head under fire. The company commanders seemed to know their jobs, especially Skip Fessmeyer and Myron Diderick. We had one or two units that had a bit of light contact out in the field. Headquarters company was a different unit than a regular line company. We were staff people, supplies, communications, and medical people. Non-combatant administrators and support people. Lieutenant Colonel Edward C. Scheimeyer, who later would become Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, was Tim Brown's executive officer in the 3rd Brigade that fall. He recollects, "A deliberate decision was made in those first operations in Vietnam and later up in Pleiku to put 2-7 in areas where it was clear they would have the opportunity to work on the fundamentals, orchestrating their movement through jungle. So they at least had some time to work together where there were not a lot of enemy. McDade was a very new battalion commander, but I should say that he had very strong company commanders and very strong NCOs with combat experience in Korea and even World War II. I knew some of those people from Korea, and they were good. Frank Henry, the executive officer, always knew what was going on. He had a good feel for getting patrols out and taking care of logistics. I thought he was a good adjunct and prop for McDade during his learning period." One of the strengths of the 2nd Battalion was Sergeant Major James Scott. He had made the landing at Normandy and was wounded in combat 3 times between June and December of 1944. He served 13 months in combat in Korea and had been with the 2nd Infantry Division at Fort Benning for 6 years. "I had 24 years service in 1965. I could have retired, but that was no time to quit when you know you are going to be needed and you have some experience. Colonel White, the battalion commander that summer, was a World War II veteran. He talked a lot about obtaining experienced personnel." Scott had his eye on Sergeant First Class Charles Bass, who was in a 2nd Division unit, but had not been ordered to Vietnam because he had just returned from a tour there as an advisor to the South Vietnamese Army. He had plenty of experience. I met him on the street in Columbus, Georgia, and he said, "Promise me a promotion and I'll volunteer to go with you." I told him he knew there was no way I can guarantee a promotion, but I'd see that he was on top of the list. So he came to us as our operations sergeant. He and I shared a tent in Vietnam. The other senior NCOs would come and pick his brain. Charles could talk for hours about how you navigate by artillery fire. Never underestimate this enemy. They have patience. Be alert to their AK-47s, a good weapon. Watch those anthills. Fire into the trees and anthills when you arrive and when you depart. This Vietnamese enemy is good. He is dedicated to his cause. That was frightening to hear, but it was all truth. Lieutenant S. Lawrence Gwynn was young, blonde, 6'2" tall. He was one of those who heard John F. Kennedy's clarion call and answered it. He was commissioned regular Army out of Yale University ROTC in June 1963. Not only was he ranger and parachute qualified, but he also had 3 months schooling in the Vietnamese language. In September 1965, he was advising a South Vietnamese battalion in the Mekong Delta, when he was suddenly transferred north and assigned to 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, as the executive officer of Alpha Company under Captain Joel Sugdinis. Gwynn says, "McDay took over, and for several weeks he quietly observed, giving only what I would call sotto voce orders. There was a clean sweep in the battalion command structure. Major Frank Henry replaced Pete Mallet. The S-3 was replaced by Captain Jim Spires, whom I liked because he had also been an advisor. The S-2 was Lieutenant Mike Calla, fairly new at the game. So we went up to play a coup with a fairly unfamiliar command structure. Basically, this battalion was a terrific group of soldiers with solid NCOs. Shortcomings. They were from the 2nd Division, not a cavalry unit. They were untrained in airmobile operations. Luckily, Captain Sugdenis had transferred in from Delta Company 1-7. He was a West Point graduate, well-trained, and an outstanding officer. The one person who lives in a commander's back pocket is his radio operator, connected by that 6-foot-long, black plastic-covered electrical umbilical cord. Jim Epperson, then 26, a native of Oakland, California, had been John White's radio operator. Now he was Bob McDade's. White was a leader-type person, Epperson recalls. Perhaps a bit more nitpicky. He ran us more like we were a stateside unit. McDade was more laid back. He had come to us from a staff position, hadn't been with troops for a long time. I got along with both of them, but McDade was a little more personable. I liked McDade because I used to get double C rations, mine and his. All he would eat was pound cake and fruit. Regular C rats tore his stomach up bad, so he just didn't eat. He was tall and slender and wore a gold bracelet. Lieutenant Colonel McDade has this to say about his battalion. Until I took command of 2-7, I had no real dealings with the organization. My impression was that everybody seemed competent. I don't think they had had much experience at the time, but then again, not many other outfits had either. It was an outfit that hadn't been tested. General Kennard sent Major Frank Henry down to be with me because he had heavy airmobile and helicopter experience, having worked very closely with Kennard as his aide. That was to give us the helicopter expertise Frank Henry had. My experience was purely as an infantryman. Back at Holloway this Wednesday, November 17th, we spent the morning finishing the cleanup of men, weapons, and gear, issuing clothing, reorganizing our depleted ranks, and beginning to process the paperwork for men due to return to the United States for discharge from service within the next week or 10 days. Now the men were relaxing. Some slept. Some wrote letters. Some drank beer. Some did a bit of all those things. Rick Riscorla says, Bravo 2-7 spent a comfortable night rolled up in poncho liners, sleeping in platoon formations alongside the road near the Holloway landing zone. Awakening on the morning of 17 November, relaxed by the promise that we would be heading back to Angers, the mood was, we've done our bit, it's home to beautiful Angers. Meanwhile, hang loose and wait for the rest of 2-7 Battalion, clean weapons, wolf down hot rations. No sweat. By mid-afternoon, weapons under guard, men were swilling beer at the NCO and EM, enlisted men's clubs, or gulping candy bars and soda at the store. 31 miles southwest of Camp Holloway in the Iadrang Valley, the column of American troops pulled out of X-ray at 9 a.m. as directed. The word among Bob McDade's troopers was that it was going to be a walk in the sun, a stroll over to another landing zone, where the helicopters would come in and extract them. The first leg of the journey home to Angers Base Camp. The word was wrong. Albany. Chapter 18. A Walk in the Sun. I will tell you one thing that sticks in my mind. This was the least airmobile operation that occurred probably in the entire Vietnam War. It was right back to 1950 Korea or 1944 Europe. All we got were verbal orders. Go here, finger on map. And we just marched off like we were in Korea. Colonel Robert A. McDade. Call it fate. Call it Custer's luck. Whatever it was, it sure as hell had nothing to do with air mobility. The two battalions that had inherited landing zone X-ray were about to abandon it, and they were leaving the same way they had arrived, on foot.
Whatever the 1st Cavalry Division's 435 helicopters were doing this sunny Wednesday morning, November 17, 1965, they were not available to move Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully's 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry, to LZ Columbus, or Lieutenant Colonel Robert McDade's 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, to the spot on the map that was designated LZ Albany. Grumbling and groaning, the men of both battalions loaded their packs. The word had come down. The big Air Force B-52 bombers were already airborne out of Guam, and their target was the near slopes of Chu Pong Mountain. Friendly forces had to be well outside a 2-mile safety zone by mid-morning when upward of 200 tons of 500-pound bombs would begin raining down from 36,000 feet. At 9 a.m., Bob Tully's men moved out heading northeast. Says Tully, "We spent the night there with McDade's battalion. I was told to go to Columbus. We were the lead out of LZ X-ray and moved out the same way we came in. Two companies up, one back. We used artillery to plunk around out 400 yards or so every half hour so we could have a concentration plotted. That way, if we ran into problems, we could immediately call for fire." 10 minutes later, Bob McDade's soldiers moved out. The 3rd Brigade's commanding officer, Tim Brown, was on the ground in X-ray at the time, watching the movement. Brown's instructions to McDade were to follow Tully's battalion. A little more than halfway to LZ Columbus, McDade's battalion would head northwest for LZ Albany. This clearing at map coordinates YA-945043 was 625 yards south of the Iadrang. Chief Warrant Officer Hank Ainsworth, a 28-year-old native of Weatherford, Oklahoma, had 10 years in the Army, the last year and a half as a Huey pilot in the 11th Air Assault Division and the 1st Cavalry Division. Hank was pilot of the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry Command Helicopter this day. "I was assigned the mission to take the 2-7 Command Chopper on a recon flight. We flew an area north of X-ray the morning of the 17th of November. People on board were looking at 2 or 3 different LZs for potential use. They picked Albany, the smallest of those we overflew, really a one-ship LZ. We flew low level, 300 or 400 feet above the trees, checking the route they would take going in there. I saw absolutely nothing to indicate there was enemy on the ground. We drew no fire." As 2nd Battalion 7th Cav headed out of X-ray that morning, what was its mission? The operations journals of the 3rd Brigade and the 1st and 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry are not available in the National Archives and have not been located despite an ongoing search by the Center for Military History that dates back to September 1967. Why these crucial documents disappeared remains a mystery. The Division After Action Report of March 1966 states that the 2nd Battalion was to sweep to the west and northwest toward a map location that appeared it would make a possible landing zone. The map location YA-945043 was named Albany. Colonel Tim Brown, the 3rd Brigade's commander, remembers, "My intentions were that Albany was just an intermediate thing, that McDade was to go on through to LZ Crooks. I wanted to move 2-7 onto Crooks rather than have them all, 2-5 and 2-7 and 1-5, congregate on Columbus. We had to support the South Vietnamese who were coming up, so I was going to just swing on out west. The mission hadn't changed. We were still out there to try to find the enemy. So I had them move out by foot. I could move them out by air later if I had to. Albany was just a spot on the route. Just pass through and on to Crooks." The clearing that was called Landing Zone Crooks was 8.1 miles northwest of X-ray at map coordinates YA-872126. Across those miles, as the crow flies, lay the Iadrang Valley. LZ Albany was 2 miles northeast of X-ray and 6.8 miles southeast of Crooks. Shy Meyer says that because of the B-52 strikes, the 2 battalions on X-ray had to be moved. "The proposal was for 2-7 to move over north and find a suitable LZ. I don't think there was even an Albany plotted on the map. Later, when I had to brief the press, it was clear to me that this thing could not have been a classic ambush, since the enemy did not know where we were going. Hell, nobody knew where this battalion was going."
Lieutenant Colonel Bob McDade, the 2nd Battalion's commander, was in the dark, too.
We really didn't know a goddamn thing, had no intelligence, when Tully and I left X-ray. We had no idea what to expect out there. They told me to go to a place called Albany and establish an LZ. Nobody said we would have to fight our way to that LZ, just go and establish it. There are other things that follow from this. There is the time pressure. They say, get there and organize the LZ. So you plow through, you don't feel your way or creep along. So I just blundered ahead. That was my objective, so let's go. We were on foot going toward Albany all morning. We had word we were to stop and hold for an hour or so while the B-52 strikes went in. We sat on our asses, then started again.
Captain James W. Spires, McDade's Battalion S-3, or Operations Officer, recalls that their mission was to stop any NVA movement along the Iadrang.
It was thought they were coming in along that route from Cambodia to attack our fire bases. It was thought that eventually we would be extracted out of that LZ or from another in that vicinity.
Asked about intelligence information or any alert of danger, Spires says,
nothing specific that I was aware of. No reports of anything in there.
Sergeant Major Scott.
On the 17th of November, early that morning, I heard we would move to another landing zone. I asked Sergeant Charles Bass, what's our mission? He said, one of three possibilities. Engage the enemy, evacuate the area for the B-52s, or be picked up and transported back to Anhe.
Captain Dudley Tatamy, Colonel Tim Brown's 3rd Brigade Fire Support Coordinator, FFC, was to coordinate all the supporting fires, tactical air, artillery, aerial rocket artillery.
My place of duty was wherever Tim Brown was.
The FSC stays in the hip pocket of the commander, immediately available to respond to any developing situation. We habitually took off early in the morning and stayed out all day in the command chopper. We did have B-52 scheduled to come in on the Massif, and we had to get off that LZ. They were moving toward another location, unnamed, just another circle on the map. We needed to get those folks out of that hole they were in. LZ X-ray. We had had troopers sitting there for 4 days. Sergeant Major Scott was with the battalion command group as the battalion left X-ray.
We started moving out in formation in company column. We had medical people, the chaplain's assistant, the personnel section, some of the cooks and bakers. The first sergeant and commander of headquarters company were with us too. Captain William Schuchart was the battalion surgeon. He and the medical platoon leader, Lieutenant John Howard, and the assistant medical platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Charles W. Story, were with the column, too.
Just before Alpha Company's 2nd Battalion moved out, its commander, Captain Joel Sugdinis, put out an unusual order. His executive officer, Lieutenant Larry Gwynn, remembers it well.
The company had been on 100% alert for over 52 hours. We were in such a state of exhaustion that Captain Sugdinis directed that each man take 2 APC tablets, aspirin with caffeine, a move designed to increase the mental alertness of the troops. The recon platoon under Lieutenant Pat Payne was attached to us and was designated as the point because they'd led the battalion overland into LZ X-ray the previous day over some of the same terrain. Sugdinis said, "The enemy situation is unclear, but there are NVA in the area. We proceed to Albany, secure an LZ for possible return to play coup. We were tactically deployed and expecting to run into somebody. We had been told by Sugdinis to stay alert."
Before taking over Alpha Company 2nd Battalion, Sugdinis had served in the 1st Battalion. When Colonel Brown asked for an officer to take over Alpha Company, Sugdinis was immediately nominated. Joel, 28 and a West Point graduate, had a wealth of troop duty behind him, including 2 years in the 11th Air Assault Test and 1st Cavalry. He also had seen a year of combat, 1962 to 1963, as an advisor to a Vietnamese infantry battalion. Sugdinis says,
"When I requested artillery support to proceed our movement to Albany, battalion informed me that we would not recon by fire because it would reveal our presence or something like that.
I was not told that 2nd of the 5th Cav would recon by fire as they moved. As pointer lead element in the 2-7, I put my company into a V formation. I put the recon platoon, now attached in the lead or center, and each of my two remaining rifle platoons in echelon to the right and to the left. I placed my own command group in the center on the heels of the recon platoon. We were to initially follow the 2-5 battalion, which we did. Captain Henry Hank Thorpe, a North Carolinian, was a Mustang. That is, he had won a direct commission from the ranks in the early 1960s. He was in command of Delta Company, which followed behind Sugdinus's men in the column. Says Thorpe, "We were just told to follow the outfit in front. It was a walk in the sun. Nobody knew what was going on." Following Delta were Captain John A. Skip Fessmeyer's Charlie Company troopers, who also began the move in a wedge formation. During the first halt in the movement, it became immediately apparent that controlling this type of formation in the tall grass would be difficult if a firefight were to break out. Fessmeyer recalls, "Charlie Company platoon and squad leaders had PRC-6s, Korean War vintage walkie-talkies, but they were unreliable. Furthermore, once a soldier was down in the tall grass, squad leaders had a tough time locating them. Therefore, after the first halt, I put the company in a column formation with platoons in column. We were not the lead element, nor the trail element. We were following D Company, which was the combat support company." Second Lieutenant Enrique V. Pujals of Hato Rey, Puerto Rico, had led the 3rd platoon of Captain Fessmeyer's Charlie Company for about 1 month. "My impression was that it was simply a get-out-as-fast-as-you-can thing because of the B-52 strike. Our company was to move in company column with platoons in column. It sounded like one of those admin marches at Benning right after an exercise ended." Specialist 4 Jack P. Smith, 20, Washington, D.C., who had joined the Army to do some growing up after he flunked out of college, was assigned to Fessmeyer's company. "The order came for us to move out. I guess our commanders felt the battle was over. The 3 battalions of PAVN were destroyed. There must have been about 1,000 rotting bodies out there. As we left the perimeter, we walked by them. Some of them had been out there for 4 days. The next unit of the 2nd Battalion in the line of march was the Battalion Headquarters Company of Logistics and Admin Clerks, the Battalion Aid Station Medic, Supply People, the Chaplain's Assistant, Communications Officer and his Radio Repairman, and the like. 2nd Lieutenant John Howard, a native Pennsylvanian, was a Medical Service Corps officer and Administrative Assistant to the Battalion Surgeon. He recalls spending the night of November 16th in X-ray beside Staff Sergeant Story. "Charlie Story came over to me before we moved out of X-ray that morning and asked me to help him light a cigarette because he was too nervous to hold the match. I tried to calm him down with casual conversation, but he remained very nervous. I think he was having some kind of premonition," Howard says. Lieutenant Alley, the battalion communications officer, was also with headquarters company. "We were told that this would be a tactical move. There was still a lot of stuff on the battlefield, equipment, supplies, captured stuff that had to be policed up and blown up, all in a hurry-up situation. I was personally carrying an RC-292 antenna in addition to my regular combat load. I weighed about 140 pounds. My normal combat load was 40 or 50 pounds. The 292 antenna weighed 60 pounds. The temperature must have been 96, and the humidity was the same. We were moving as fast as we could through the elephant grass and scrub oaks, some high canopy. We were humping, everyone tired as could be." At heart, almost as much an infantry officer as a medical doctor, Captain William Schuchart marched in the column toward Albany. Doc Schuchart was one of the most highly regarded officers in the battalion. He went to school at the University of Missouri, then to Washington University Medical School. "I was a resident at Peter Bent Brigham Hospital in Boston when I got drafted. Initially, I had a medical deferment, but I lost it when I switched to a surgical residency. I was assigned to the burn unit at Brooke Army Hospital in San Antonio.
I got involved in sports with a bunch of great enlisted men in the afternoons. When the Vietnam thing came up, the Tonkin Gulf, a lot of those guys were sent over. I was single and thought it was an important thing to do. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I flew to Long Beach and caught up with a troop ship that had left the East Coast earlier. Schuchart adds, the guys who taught me most about the Army were Lieutenant Rick Rescorla, an Englishman, and Sergeant John Driver, who was an Irishman. Driver did tunnel rat work. He would drop down in there and yell, anybody home? He didn't throw his smoke in first like everyone else.